Welcome once again to our program, Salvation History, the Old Testament, the story of creation, fall, and the beginning of the redemption of the salvation of all humankind. Our guest, of course, is Ron Eldred, who teaches religion and history at John Paul II Catholic High here in town, and I'm your host, Father Larry Moran, the chaplain down at the Carmelite Convent, just at the entrance to Allendale, south of Terre Haute. Ron, welcome once again. We've been talking about, well, Moses, the commandments on Mount Sinai, the Ten Commandments, and then the Mitzvot, and the Torah, the five books of Moses, where we got these, the Jewish people got the 613 commandments that then received endless numbers, hundreds, and even thousands of interpretations. And the reason we've been talking about them is because they're the basis of Jesus' relationship with the Jewish people at the time. And we went through six different categories about laws about agricultural farming, through about the Sabbath, about the temple, about food, about ritual purity, which was a very big concern, particularly of Jesus at Pharisees at the time of Jesus. We went through about marriage. So we're really remind us of the reason now that Catholics and other Christians, we ought to know about the Jewish system of law, especially as it applied to the period of the Old Testament. What's the reason we're spending time on this that is so important for us as New Testament people?
Well, for one thing, one simply can't understand the Old Testament covenants without a knowledge of the law or the Torah. The Torah was the heart of the agreement between God and the Israelites. It was the covenant. It was the agreement between God and the chosen people, the Israelites. And furthermore, we simply can't understand the New Testament without an understanding of the Old Testament. As St. Augustine said in the 4th century, the New Testament is concealed or hidden in the Old, and the Old is revealed in the New. The New Testament, in other words, is the fulfillment of the Old. So, Testament means covenant. And the covenant, the heart of the covenant, was the Torah, and the Torah, the heart of the Torah, was the mitzvot, these 613 laws that you just made reference to, especially, of course, the Ten Commandments.
Okay, so the Torah, of course, is the first five books of Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, and then we get these 613 laws of the mitzvah that have become so important. And that even St. Paul got into some real misunderstandings when he talked about getting free, that we're no longer subject to the law or Torah. Help us with that, because many people have misinterpreted what Paul was talking about.
Yes, that's a complex question, one that we will address in some detail in the section when we get to the New Testament. But for now, this question is at the heart of the antinomian controversy within Protestant Christianity and the debate over faith and works among Catholics and Protestants and other issues. Also, it gave rise to the issue of the Judaizers, which was solved at the Council of Jerusalem in the year 49 AD. And we'll take up these issues in some detail when we get to the New Testament and how the Council of Jerusalem, which was held in 49-50, AD to solve this whole problem that had to do with the law.
But obviously Paul wasn't saying we still do have to keep the Ten Commandments.
That's correct.
Okay.
What he was really referring to when we don't, that any pagan becoming a Christian didn't have to adhere to this whole mitzvot, these dietary, these ritual purity, a lot of the details, sabbatical laws and things of that sort. And especially the men would not have to become circumcised, because this really militated against a lot of pagan men from joining the Catholic Church. The fact there were a lot more women in the early church when St. Paul would go around preaching in the various parts on his three missionary journeys, there were a lot more women because the men might go to what was called the proselyte stage, but they wouldn't become a full-fledged Jew like the women because they'd have to become circumcised to do that. And that gets to be a really, really big issue, of course, in the New Testament times. And I said we'll address that issue.
Well, give us a few examples of how you see that in New Testament times.
Well, for example, you mean some of St. Paul's references? Yes. Well, in Colossians 2, chapter 2, verses 13 through 14, St. Paul says, "And you who were dead in trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, God made alive together with him, having forgiven us, given us all our trespasses, having canceled the bond which stood against us with its legal demands. This he set aside, nailing it to the cross." He's talking about now this mitzvah, you know, most of these laws. In Romans 6:14, for example, "For sin will have no dominion over you, since you are not under the law, but under grace." And in Acts 13:38 through 39, quote, "Let it be known to you, therefore, brethren," this is St. Paul speaking, "that through this man forgiveness of sins is proclaimed to you, and by him everyone that believes is freed from everything from which you could not be freed by the law of Moses." And then in Galatians 3:23-24, "Now, before faith came, we were confined under the law, kept under restraint until faith should be revealed, so that the law was our custodian until Christ came, that we might be justified by faith." And then finally, Romans 7, chapter 7, verse 6, "But now we are discharged from the law, dead to that which held us captive, so that we serve not under the old written code, but in the new life of the Spirit."
Okay. Now, to clarify, keep pointing about this, even though St. Paul spoke often about Christians not being under the law of Moses, he didn't mean that they were free from observing the Ten Commandments and the many commandments of the mitzvah that were related to the Ten Commandments. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. He was more referring to laws dealing with ritual purity, dietary regulations, Jewish liturgy, ritual, temple sacrifices, some of the sabbatical laws, and above all, the requirement that men had to be circumcised. In fact, Jesus refined and perfected the Ten Commandments in his Sermon on the Mount and elsewhere, for he came not to abolish the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them. But Jesus basically frees us from all of these very strict laws that were specially designed by God for the Israelites so they could be set apart from all of the pagan people around them.
It was an attempt to build a fence.
Yes, that's true.
And protect the Jewish people that they could be worthy of bringing the Messiah into the world.
Well, as we'll find out, of course, it didn't work very well. But we'll be spending several sessions on that, too. The 1913 edition of the Catholic Encyclopedia states in an article on the Judaizers, "The Judaizers were Jewish Christians who said that you basically had to become a Jew, that when a pagan became a Christian, they had to first become a Jew and practice all the 613 mitzvot." And St. Paul, of course, was against that because he thought it was far too much of a burden for, you know, pagans to have to take on, to actually practice the Jewish religion, and on top of that, practice Catholicism.
And even, would we say, it was too much a burden for Jewish people.
Yes, it was, because probably at the time of Christ, most of them didn't adhere to it. The big ones they had to be careful about. That's the one the scribes and Pharisees could haul you into court, you know, before the Sanhedrin or something of that sort. Paul, the Catholic Encyclopedia says in regard to the Judaizers, quote, "Paul, on the other hand, not only did not object to the observance of the Mosaic law as long as it did not interfere with the liberty of the Gentiles. But he conformed to his prescriptions when occasion required. Thus he shortly, after the Council of Jerusalem, circumcised Timothy. And we talked about this in one of my classes the other day, in fact, at John Paul II Catholic High School. And he was in the very act of observing the Mosaic ritual when he was arrested at Jerusalem. So even though Paul becomes a Christian and tells people that he's converting, the pagans he's converting, they don't have to practice this law of Moses. Now again, not the Ten Commandments, of course. He himself continued to practice, being the old Pharisee that he was, continued to, you know, go to the temple, go to the synagogue probably on Saturday, and then say Mass on Sunday, you know, in someone's private home or something of that sort.
Say a word again. I thought it was so eloquent, Ron, when we were talking off radio here about Paul, how well he knew the law. That he was an expert in the law as a Pharisee. So he knew what he was talking about the unbearable burden that the law was upon people.
Well, Paul came from Cilicia, which was one of the provinces in Asia Minor, what would be Turkey today. And as a young boy, he was probably, his father was a tent maker. His father had a business and he made tents out of goat hair. And Paul had learned that trade, of course, and that's how he made his living, you know, during his missionary journeys. But as a young boy, when he was about 17, and he was very well educated before he went to Jerusalem to study to be a Pharisee. He had studied Greek philosophy, probably. Tarsus was the center of Greek philosophy at that time, the philosophy of Socrates and Plato and Aristotle and, you know, lots of others. And so there's been a lot of debate whether or not Paul was really how well educated he was. But you can see this in some of his letters later on when he goes, he has a pretty good knowledge and a familiarity with Greek philosophy, pagan philosophy.
But he certainly knew absolutely the details of the law.
Oh, yes.
Jewish law.
And so he knew what he was really talking about. And his father sent him to Jerusalem when he was about 17 years old to go to the Pharisee school of Gamaliel, who was one of the greatest all-time rabbis. And in fact, Gamaliel even spoke up on behalf of the Christians after Jesus ascended into heaven, you read in the Acts of the Apostles, but that's a story we'll wait to talk about later. But nonetheless, he learns the Torah in detail. He learns the 613 mitzvot in detail, and he had to memorize them. He learns all of the hundreds, maybe thousands of interpretations that were oral. He had to learn these interpretations of these laws. And as I said, there were probably thousands of them. He had to memorize these. So no one would have known any more about the law than St. Paul.
Okay, I think that's so helpful a background. As you said, Paul, if anybody, knew what he was talking about. Well, how about one of the last things the Israelites did before they left Mount Sinai was to construct the Ark and the Tabernacle. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, now we're kind of going back and picking up where we left off when we started talking about the Law of Moses. That followed, of course, the Moses coming down from, you know, Mount Sinai. So we were just simply trying to get a little more knowledge of what the Law was all about. That it wasn't just the Ten Commandments. It also was a lot of other things that God gave to Moses during that 40 days and probably at other times. During the 40 years in the desert wilderness. But going back to this idea of the Ark, chapters 36 through 42 of Exodus describes in detail the materials and the skilled labor provided by the Israelites in accordance with God's instructions to construct the Ark and the Tabernacle, as well as the sacred vessels and utensils. The sacred vessels for Aaron and his sons, they were the high priest, and Aaron, of course, or the chief priest, and Aaron was the high priest. The furniture, such as the shewbread table, sometimes it's called showbread table, lampstands and lamps, the altar of incense, various linen and wool curtains, dyed skins for the tabernacle. The tabernacle, remember, was a tent. Well, the 40 years they were out in the desert wilderness, and God gave Moses very, very detailed instructions how this tent was to be made. The altar of Holocaust, the laver. That was a rather sizable bronze
wash bowl,
rather sizable, that they used, the priests used for ritual purification. Later on, of course, in Solomon's temple, the laver was huge. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was placed on top of 12 oxen, big brass oxen to hold it on their backs. And they had spigots on it, you know, and I imagine. And the priest, as they were doing their ritualistic rituals in the sacrificing and all that kind of thing, would have to be sometimes, practically speaking, washing their hands, you know, but other times more ritualistic in a sense. And also, God gave the details required for worship, other things. And Moses collected from the people all the materials needed to construct these items, which included gold, silver, and bronze, violet, purple and scarlet yarn, fine linen and goat hair, ram skins dyed red, and tahash skins, acacia wood, oil for the lamps, spices for the anointing oil and for fragrant incense, gemstones and other gems for mounting on the ephod or on the breastplate of the high priest. This ephod was a device that hung around from the high priest's head, and it had these 12 stones on it, each a different color, representing each of the tribes of Israel. That was his symbol, I suppose, of authority over the 12 tribes, as well as other materials. So, moreover, the people contributed their talents in addition to all these materials for making the tabernacle and the things that went along with it. They contributed their talents. They constructed these items, including spinners and embroiderers and craftsmen skilled in making things of gold and silver and bronze, engravers, jewelers skilled in cutting and mounting of precious stones, carpenters skilled in carving, yarn and cloth makers, dyers, weavers, and other crafts. You know, there's around, as we said in one of our earlier sessions, everywhere from 50 to half a million people. They're not really sure how many there were. I think we kind of settled on maybe 100,000 seemed to be kind of a reasonable number. But that's a large number of people, of course.
You mean leaving in the Exodus?
Yeah, leaving in the Exodus. 40 years, of course, of the desert wilderness. And a lot of these people, they'd accumulated things, and they had all kinds of skills. And so, obviously, they didn't have anybody else to rely on. So they had to rely on themselves for their materials and, you know, for the skilled laborers to make them into the tabernacle or the tent that was going to be the portable temple for the Israelites during their 40 years in the desert wilderness.
All right, now, didn't the Israelites leave Mount Sinai soon after completing the building of the ark and the tabernacle or the tent?
Yes, when the work was completed and the Passover observed, a cloud covered the tabernacle. And the glory of the Lord filled the dwelling, as it says in Holy Scripture. And whenever the cloud, symbolizing the Lord's presence, lifted from the tabernacle, the Israelites would set out on their journey. But they would stay put as long as the cloud remained. During the daytime, the cloud stayed over the tabernacle. But fire could be seen in the cloud at night throughout the wanderings in the desert wilderness. This symbolizes, again, the presence of the Lord. I was trying to think of the Jewish word that Shekinah symbolizes the presence of the Lord. And so the smoke and the fire, of course, does that in this particular case. The Israelites stayed in the region of Sinai for about a year, it's believed, and a census of the people was taken before they left the region, which is recorded, of course, in the book of Numbers. That's why it's called the book of Numbers, mm-hmm. Although it contains a lot more information than just, of course, you know, the taking of the census. And only the tribe of Levi was not counted because, as we discussed in one of our earlier sessions, they were entrusted with God's priesthood. And the book of Leviticus treats of the history of the wanderings of the of Israel, the tribes of Israel, from Mount Sinai to the Jordan River over a period of about 38 or 39 more years. And as soon as the tabernacle was finished, it was dedicated and the Levites were ordained.
Okay, and of course, the Ark of the Covenant and the Tent of the Tabernacle traveled with them.
Yes.
okay, and they were guided, as Scripture says, a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night.
Yeah, most of the time they would have stayed in one place for, you know, a few weeks or a month or so. They would have to go into places where there was some grass, you know, a pasture to feed their many, many goats and sheep and cattle, and it probably numbered in the many thousands, of course. So it would have been, you couldn't have stayed, you know, in one place too long.
Sure. Ron, you mentioned that a census was taken of the Israelites before they left Mount Sinai. Could you tell us a little about that?
Logically, this story is told in the book of Numbers, as I just mentioned a while ago, and the book, of course, gets its name from the counting of the tribes of Israel. And as I also said, the tribe of Levi was not counted because they were assigned the priesthood. And the book outlines the history of the Israelites from their wanderings in the desert wilderness from Mount Sinai to the Jordan River during that whole 39 years. Lepers and other unclean persons were removed from the camp. This is required and tells all about this in Numbers 5, chapter 5. And the people were consecrated. We find this in Numbers chapter 6. And as we indicated earlier, when the tabernacle was finished, it was dedicated. That story is found in chapter 7 of Numbers. And the Levites were ordained. That's found in chapter 8. Then this cloud that we mentioned a while ago of smoke and fire appeared over the tabernacle after the Passover was celebrated. We find this in Numbers 9. So, you know, there's a lot more in Numbers than just about the census. And after these things happened, the Israelites left Mount Sinai following the Ark of the Covenant. And this is found, of course, in Numbers 10.
All right. Could you tell us a little bit more about the census?
Well, it was during the second month in the wilderness, yet the Israelites were still camped around Mount Sinai, that God told Moses to take a census of the people by families, by fathers' houses, according to the number of names, every male head by head, from 20 years old and upward, all in Israel who are able to go forth to war. You and Aaron shall number them, company by company. And there shall be with you a man from each tribe, and each man bring the head of the house of his fathers. This is found in Numbers 1. Now, after choosing the heads of each of the 12 tribes to help him and Aaron do the census, they assembled and counted the people as God had commanded.
Now, what kind of numbers did they actually come up with?
The numbers recorded in the book of Numbers is highly exaggerated. For example, the count of males over 20 for the tribe of Reuben, remember there was 12 tribes, each of these were originally 400 years before that, sons of Jacob, or Israel. Reuben, 46,500. And the count for the tribe of Judah was 74,600, and so forth. The total number of men over 20 was 603,550. These are the numbers given again in the book of Numbers. If by extrapolation we double the number by counting women over 20 and doubling the number again to account for all of the children under 20, we come up with a total number of Israelites of about 2.5 million. A highly inflated number, and this doesn't even count the Levites and the many animals in the flocks and herds, which would have been, you know, in the thousands, maybe even the tens of thousands. And as we said in an earlier session, the total number of people couldn't have been more than maybe 200,000. And some scholars consider the actual number to be as low as 20,000, although I think that's probably far too small. Well, whatever the number, the Levites camped around the tabernacle and the various tribes in their own designated areas around the Levites encamped, around the tabernacle. In other words, the tabernacle was set up right in the middle of the whole thing, and the tabernacle had a fence around it. The fence was made out of linen. It's probably about 6-8 feet high. And God even told him how big the fence had to be and what had to be made out of and how it was supposed to be put up and who was supposed to put it up and all that kind of stuff. Then the tabernacle, the tent, was put up inside this fence. And then the Levites camped in their families, the tribe of Levi, the priest, they camped around the perimeter of the fence.
The linen fence?
Yes, the linen fence. And then the other 12 tribes, or other 11 tribes, would have their own area, and they'd all camp together. The tribe of Reuben, the tribe of Judah would all be together. All their families would be camped together. So it must have been a very, you know, huge camp.
Okay.
And at night, of course.
And quite orderly.
And quite orderly, sure. And right in the middle at night, you could see, during the day, you could see the smoke rising from the tabernacle. And, of course, at night, you could see the flames within the smoke, symbolizing, of course, representing the presence of God.
Okay, if we can, let's go back to the Israelites and their famous wandering in the desert for some 40 years.
Yes. A lot has happened to the Israelites since we left them back in the book of Exodus. And our story picks up again in the book of Numbers, as we just indicated. And as we've discussed, this book receives its name from the census or numbering taken of the tribes of Israel. And only the tribe of Levi was not counted, because they were entrusted with the ceremonies of the Lord. And as we also said, the book describes the history of the wanderings of Israel from Mount Sinai to the Jordan River, a period of about 38, maybe 39 years. And the preceding book of Leviticus accounts for the 2 years that they were in the region of Mount Sinai. You know, it's been estimated they were in around Mount Sinai between 1 and 2 years.
All right.
And then, of course, the book of Numbers describes the rest of the 38 years. Mostly in the region called Kadesh, which had plenty of water and grazing land for their herds of cattle and flocks of sheep and goats. They couldn't have just stayed in the desert wilderness. They would have to go as much as they could where there was some rain and some water and this, that, and the other springs, you know, and things like that. They would have grass to feed their sheep and goats and cattle. In addition to what they obtained from their animals for food, God provided them with natural bread called manna, as well as quail. Manna was the food that God provided, bread from heaven, to feed the children of Israel daily in the wilderness for 40 years of their journey in Canaan. Although God miraculously provided the bread, they had to work for it and to follow his instructions in gathering it. It was available only in the morning, early morning, from the dew. And they had to gather it early because it would evaporate by the time the sun was up. Furthermore, it had to be gathered every day because any amount left on the ground would breed worms and smell. Moreover, they had to gather a double portion on the sixth day, you know, in anticipation of the Sabbath, because they couldn't work on the Sabbath. It was called manna because this is the Hebrew word for what is it? It looked like white coriander seed and tasted like wafer biscuits made from honey, according to Exodus 16:31. The Lord guided them by day with a pillar of smoke and a pillar of fire by night. And then one other thing I'd like to say, because we're just about time, just about up. Numbers also describes how those who were suffering from leprosy or the unclean were removed from the camp. It also relates the story of the construction of the tabernacle and its dedication, and also tells the story of the ordination of the Levites, and how the cloud of fire appeared over the tabernacle after the Lord told Moses to celebrate the Passover. So that pretty well takes us through the book of Numbers.
Okay, well, fortunately, our time has concluded for us, and we'll be talking about Moses going on to the promised land in the next round. So to our listening audience, we say, may God bless you all, always, and in all ways.